Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, December 21st. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, offering its pain management program led by Dr. Gordon Kuhar, focused on reducing or eliminating chronic pain with patient-centered treatment plans, saratogahospital.org. Joining us today for Medical Monday are two experts on strokes, Dr. William Musser and Dr. Jonathan Wolpaw. This promises to be a busy show, so I advise you to call in early. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number, 800-348-2551. Dr. William Musser, Dr. Jonathan Wolpaw, and your questions about strokes coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and we welcome two doctors today. Dr. William Musser is a vascular neurologist and has been in practice for over 20 years. He's practiced neurology in both university and private practice settings, but has been a neurologist with the Department of Veterans Affairs for the last 10 years. Dr. Musser is the former chief of neurology at Albany VA and is currently the chief medical officer of the VA National Telestroke Program. He obtained his medical degree from Albany Medical College in 1992, completed residency in both neurology and psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical School. Also joined today by Dr. Jonathan Wolpaw, is a neurologist engaged in basic and clinical neuroscience research for more than 40 years. He's director of the National Center for Adaptive Neurotechnologies at the Albany Stratton VA Medical Center. His research has focused on spinal cord injuries and now explores the use of new technology to improve rehabilitation after strokes. If you want to be part of our conversation today, give us a shout, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. William Musser, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Ray. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you here, and we'll get into this business of what this telestroke program is in a moment, but first let's welcome Dr. Jonathan Wolpaw to the show. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Nice to have you both here, and I'll throw this one up to both of you, and then we'll get into sort of the nitty-gritty of where we are with treatment and prevention and this telestroke program. For those who don't know, give us a general, brief explanation of what actually happens in a stroke.
I can take that one. So what happens in a stroke, Ray, is that there is an interruption of blood flow to one of the blood vessels going to the brain. And there are two main ways that this can happen. One is that there is atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries, and that causes a vessel to, over time, slowly begin to close off until one day it closes off and occludes completely. The other cause that's fairly common is an embolus, that is, a blood clot forms somewhere else in the body. Usually it's in the heart, and that travels up to the brain and blocks off a vessel. The brain requires a constant supply of oxygen and glucose, which is sugar. And once it's deprived of that, the tissues will die very quickly. And in the brain, when that happens, you have a stroke, so a small area of the brain or a large area will die, but outside, and that area cannot be recovered. But outside of that area is something that is often a larger area called the ischemic penumbra. This is tissue that's losing blood flow, but it still has some blood flow. It's damaged, but it can recover, perhaps even completely. And it's that area that vascular neurologists, stroke neurologists, and other neurologists as well are very focused on saving.
Yeah, Dr. Wolpaw, we see almost every day, if we are regular TV watchers, public awareness campaigns about the importance of getting to the doctor as quickly as possible if you think you're having a stroke. Why is that so important?
Well, Dr. Musser alluded to that in his answer, that the brain is very sensitive to the loss of blood flow, the loss of oxygen, the loss of glucose, very sensitive. And basically, I mean, there's sort of a saying that time is brain, that you want to do whatever you can to relieve that loss as quickly as you can, to prevent it becoming permanent, to prevent permanent damage, long-term damage. If you can get to it very quickly, you can get a considerably better recovery than if you have to wait. So it's very important to get the treatment as soon as possible. I know Dr. Musser may have some more to add about that. There are new possibilities that have come up in recent years. There are new things that we can do that have made it even more important, because there are things we can do that 20 or 30 years ago weren't available if people get there quickly enough.
Well, Dr. Musser, how quickly do we have to be there for it to be quickly enough? In other words, how long is too long?
So I think one thing we like to talk to patients about, and we want the public to understand, and also we want other physicians to understand, is that time is brain. And that, you know, 2 million brain cells can die per minute, you know, and so it really is a race against time. But when we talk about some of the acute treatments that we have, and we have two, one is a treatment called Alteplase. The other name for it is tissue plasminogen activator. It is a very strong blood thinner. And it has been shown to be effective in breaking up some of these blood clots, but it needs to be given within 4.5 hours of the symptoms starting. And it's better if you give it sooner than that. So if you give it within 1 hour, that's better than giving it within two, better than within giving it within three. So that's a treatment we've had now and is commonly used. We've had that for about 20 years. The other treatment that we have that has been shown to be effective and has become really the standard of care over the past 2 years is something called mechanical thrombectomy. And what that means is, if someone has a blood clot in a large vessel, this is usually the internal carotid artery in the neck or the middle cerebral artery in the brain, and that blood clot has been there for less than 23 hours, and it looks like the patient has a penumbra, a large area of the brain that can be saved, then it has been shown to be effective and is now really the standard of care for an interventional radiologist or a neurosurgeon to snake a catheter in. They usually go in through one of the vessels in the groin, just like when someone goes and has a cardiac catheterization. And they snake that catheter all the way up, and they're able to pull out that clot.
I guess, and I'll throw this one to Dr. Walpaw. And by the way, we're joined by Dr. William Musser and Dr. Jonathan Walpaw, and we are discussing strokes today. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551. Dr. Walpaw, what I can glean then from what I've heard from you guys is that the sooner the better, and if you're, by the time you have symptoms, if you get to that hospital within 2 or 3 hours, there is a chance that you can get some very effective treatment. How soon do you have to get there? And I'll go back to this question I asked, to make a full recovery from a stroke.
Well, that's going to depend very much on you and on the nature of the stroke, the nature of your blood vessels. It's going to vary a lot from person to person, so you can't really predict what's going to happen. I mean, you can, if it's a very short time, often people can, if it really is a very brief time, you can look forward to a better, you know, more complete recovery, but it's going to vary. The thing we do know, and the operative thing that people should keep in mind, is the sooner the better. We know very definitely that the sooner we get to things, the better the results are going to be.
Hmm.
Well, what in a particular person it's going to be, you can't really predict ahead of time.
By the way, this National Telestroke Program, and I'll throw this to you, Dr. Musser, this can't be telemedicine for stroke care, can it? I mean, how can you save anyone from a distance who's having a stroke?
Well, it is just that. It is telemedicine for stroke care. So when you look at across the United States, there are fewer neurologists than we need to care for our population, and that's really across the country as a whole. I think in a in a city like Albany, you have large neurology departments at your disposal at the various hospitals. But when you look across our country, a lot of our country is rural. And there's a shortage of physicians, primary care physicians, but also specialists, and that includes neurologists. So the VA is a largest health system in the country, and a lot of our centers are rural hospitals and rural clinics or urgent cares. And so to get patients evaluated quickly and seen by stroke neurologists to determine, is this a stroke? Are they eligible for an acute treatment, and particularly Alteplase, the blood thinner we were talking about earlier? Those patients need to be seen very quickly. So not only do they need to get to the hospital very quickly, but they need to be seen by someone who can make the diagnosis and help make those decisions. And telemedicine works very well for that. Our program began with its first live site in late 2017, and we now cover 41 VA facilities across the country, including the Albany VA. And we see patients through iPad Pros, and we talk. We are able to evaluate them using FaceTime. The picture is very clear. The sound is very clear. We can see them. They can see us. We work in conjunction, in partnership with the emergency room physicians or medicine physicians at the sites to help us perform an exam. We're able to look at the patient's chart remotely. We're able to look at their CT scans and other imaging remotely and talk with the patient and talk with the local staff and make a decision. It works very well.
It has improved outcomes?
Yes, it has.
Let's take a quick break. We are joined today by Dr. William Musser and Dr. Jonathan Walpaugh, and we'll open the phones in a minute. 800-348-2551 is our number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday today, and we're joined by Dr. William Musser and Dr. Jonathan Walpaugh as we discuss strokes. And let's go right to the phones. Glenn in Johnstown. Glenn, you're up.
Hey, Ray. Thanks again, as always, for Medical Monday. Drs. Musser and Walpaugh, thank you for being here. I'm recently in remission from chronic lymphocytic lymphoma. If I had been treated around here, I would not have been able to have received the kind of care that I had gotten at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute because they're an NIH cancer, comprehensive cancer center. So I understand that the kind of treatment and medication you're talking about is available at VA and through the VA system. For the rest of us, does it help to be closer to a major medical center to be able to receive the kind of care that you need quickly? Or in my case, would I have to get somebody or, ambulance would drive me to Albany?
Well, I think in the, in the community, various hospital systems, build networks where they're able to evaluate patients. They're able to see patients through telemedicine. This is with stroke patients. It occurs in other specialties, I would imagine, as well. I can only sort of speak about how stroke is done. And if someone needs the acute treatment with the blood thinner, that is the most time-sensitive treatment because you have up to only 4.5 hours to do it, and that time goes very quickly. So that's a treatment that can be given at a local facility, and then the patient can be transferred to a comprehensive stroke center. And that is what we're seeing happen really across the country.
Glenn.
Thank you. And may I ask a quick follow-up?
Sure, go ahead.
So in a stroke, how does one have the presence of mind to know one is having a stroke if it is the brain itself that is impacted?
Okay, that's a very good question. And we teach people and we teach hospitals as well, and whether suggest that they use an acronym to help kind of identify if a person himself or herself or if a family member notices someone having a stroke. The acronym is BEFAST, B-E-F-A-S-T. And we tell people if you have any sudden onset, stroke is a sudden onset process usually. There's a sudden onset of balance difficulty, like difficulty walking, or eyes, vision loss, or double vision, or face, facial weakness, or numbness on one side of the face, or arm and or leg weakness or numbness on one side, or speech disturbance, like slurring of speech, difficulty speaking, or difficulty understanding others speaking. That those are signs of a possible stroke. The T in BFAST stands for time, as in time is brain, and that's when one wants to call 911 or present to the nearest emergency room.
All right, Glenn, thank you very much for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We're talking about strokes today on Medical Monday with Dr. William Musser and Dr. Jonathan Walpaw. And Dr. Walpaw, you have done research on spinal cord injuries. And how has that dovetailed with rehabilitation techniques for those who are improving after having had a stroke?
Right. yes, there have been really remarkable advances in the past several decades. It's really a revolutionary advances in how what we understand about brain function and how we can think about making function better after it's been damaged by a stroke or by a spinal cord injury or by multiple sclerosis or really a wide variety of other disorders. And we now understand that the brain can change a lot more than we think it could change. It used to be thought that after a damage occurs, if you have a stroke, you have a spinal cord injury, you're pretty much stuck with the results. We now know that that's not necessarily true, that the brain has the capacity to change, the capacity to regenerate cells, to regenerate function, to regenerate pathways, if it can be properly induced and enabled to do so. And what we're really at the very beginning of doing is learning the methods in which we can use to help the brain access those capabilities so that we can guide rehabilitation. We can enable the brain to recover useful function. So, and that really, the kinds of things that we do for after spinal cord injury, the basic methods are going to be similar to what they're going to be after stroke. I mean, clearly they have to be more specific to the particular problem that a particular person has, but the basic principles are pretty much the same in all these areas. And we're learning how to develop new methods, how to apply them. It's a very exciting time. It's a little frustrating in that there's so many possibilities for what we can do, and it's hard to know what to do first or what will work best. But we're at the beginning of what is a very long and complicated and ultimately very productive endeavor in which we will be able to get much better recovery than we have in the past and that we can get now once we learn this. So there needs to be both increased basic research as well as clinical research in humans. The combination of animal research as well as human research is producing really remarkable new insights to lead to better treatments. And that's beginning to come online. It's just beginning, but it's a very exciting time, and it's really great to be part of that.
We're joined today on Medical Monday by Dr. Jonathan Walpaw and Dr. William Musser. The number is 800-348-2551, and we'll get right back to the phones. I just have one question for Dr. Musser. In recounting your CV, which is quite extensive at the beginning of the show, it mentioned residency training in both neurology and psychiatry. How does the psychiatry element sort of work into what you're doing with strokes?
Well, I would say on a day-to-day basis, the psychiatry training does not work in with what I do and what my career has been. I went to Albany Medical College, as you mentioned. I had as a fourth-year student there, a very good rotation on the psychiatry service, and it got me very interested in psychiatry, and it led me in that direction. And then as I was doing my training after a few years, I realized that what interested me more, although psychiatry was fine, were the neurological cases. And so I actually started we put together a combined program.
Let's get back to the phones here. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Matt is in Albany. Matt, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
You betcha.
Good, good. What an interesting show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My question has to do with a loved one. The situation is a couple of years ago with an ablation over in Boston inside the heart, killing those nerve cells. There are irregular heartbeats that are coming back, and I'm wondering if there's any experience with telehealth that's improving with these new do-it-yourself $100 EKG devices. Does that help predict a stroke? I thought it did with heavy irregular heartbeats, and even in my own self, I have irregular heartbeat. My doctor says I got the best kind he can have. Maybe you could explain that a little bit too, but It's all heartbeats, and we got to keep them going. So thank you.
So probably the most common irregular heartbeat that is associated with stroke is atrial fibrillation, and that is where the atria, two of the chambers in the heart, when they are contracting, they're doing so in an irregular, disorganized fashion. And so blood, if it's not being pumped, if there are areas in the heart where blood can kind of sit and stagnate, then you can have blood clots begin to form. I'm not a cardiologist, but what you're describing is a common treatment for atrial fibrillation, where people are taken to the cardiac catheterization laboratory, and there is mapping that is done to see where the abnormal rhythm is coming from, and they're able to kind of ablate that or destroy that part, that pathway in the heart. In doing that, the hope is that atrial fibrillation will go away and never come back, but sometimes it does. And so that's why it's very important to follow with a physician and who keeps an eye on the heart rate and the rhythm and treats it appropriately. To answer your question about monitoring, so the Apple Watch is people are working on that to see how accurate it is in terms of finding atrial fibrillation. It will tell anyone who has an Apple Watch, it'll tell you them that they can have it set up to look for atrial fibrillation, this abnormal heart rhythm. But whether it is clinically useful to physicians is not clear yet. There was a story in the news, though, recently about a watch being made by a company. I'm forgetting the name, but it's a fairly inexpensive watch that is supposed to do the same thing. So we may see watches that are able to monitor people's heart rhythm, and that may be, set up in a system in some way where it would notify the patient's physician or provider that they're going into an abnormal heart rhythm.
Matt, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday today. We talk about strokes with Dr. Jonathan Walpaw and Dr. William Musser. And we go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim.
How likely is it that if a person has a stroke or aneurysm to have a seizure about a month later?
So seizure is something that we can see after a stroke. It can occur in about 30% of people, or one in three people who have a stroke may ultimately have a seizure related to that. So it's not uncommon.
Jim, thank you very much. Our number is 800-348-2551. Lou in Altamont. Lou, you're on.
I have three very specific questions. The first one is, if you have a stroke or a blockage, can that specific area of the brain be salvaged by any of the techniques that you discussed earlier? The second question is there any part of the brain that can have a stroke and not show any symptoms, that the damage continues and becomes permanent and larger? And the third and final question is regarding AFib. What is the increase in risk for having a stroke by having AFib?
So when someone has a stroke, and this really applies to any stroke, an area of the brain dies, and that area it cannot be recovered. Now, it may be a very small area, and that's different than, and I think it's worth mentioning this now, is some people present with what looks like a stroke, but then the symptoms resolve completely. And so it turns out that they have not had a stroke, but they've had something called a transient ischemic attack. It's kind of a warning. It lets you know that there's a problem from a vascular perspective, and that if you don't try to identify the risk factors that are causing that problem, that that person is at risk for a stroke. But in general, so that is neurologic symptoms that come or stroke symptoms that come and then resolve completely. But when people have a stroke, a small area or an area of some size dies, and that cannot be recovered. With these acute treatments, what we are interested in doing is focusing on the surrounding brain that has not died but may be at risk. That's that part of the brain that we are trying to salvage.
Okay, and the question regarding the asymptomatic areas of the brain.
Dr. Walpaw, you want to go on that one?
Yeah, in terms of whether you can have areas where you're not going to see symptoms or signs right away, that's correct, that you can have particularly small strokes in parts of the brain that aren't going to be apparent, that in fact may lead to no really measurable decrease in function, hopefully, but are not necessarily going to be immediately apparent. I mean, the warning signs that Dr. Musser mentioned are the most common and the really major things to look for. But you could have small lesions, small strokes occurring that wouldn't be apparent. They're of really considerably less concern than the major things that he talked about.
And the increase in stroke risk by having AFib.
You know, there are different numbers quoted for that, but I often explain it as there's an increased risk of stroke per year by about 5 to 7%.
All right, Lou, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday on WAMC. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jonathan Walpaw is here and Dr. William Musser. These transient ischemic attacks interest me in that, A, how do they differ from an actual stroke if the symptoms present very similarly? And two, what percentage of those who have transient ischemic attacks end up having actual strokes? We'll throw it to Dr. Walpaw first.
Well, I think that's probably more a question for Dr. Musser in terms of giving actual numbers.
Okay. Dr. Musser.
So I think just when you think about what happens in a transient ischemic attack, it's helpful to think about what happens in the blood. Our blood has the ability to clot, and it has processes that lead it to clot. It also has processes that lead it to break up blood clots. And so what happens usually in a transient ischemic attack is there is a blood clot that either forms in the location where it's going to block things off, or it's sent there, usually by the heart, but the blood clot is fragile and it breaks up quickly. So there's a brief occlusion and then the clot resolves and blood flow is restored. But that's good news when that happens. But when someone has a transient ischemic attack, the risk of stroke within the next 90 days is anywhere between, 2% to almost 20%. So we like to teach people that a TIA is a medical emergency, because if you fail to address the causes, you're really at an increased risk for a stroke occurring.
Doctors, let's take a quick break here. This is Vox Pop Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll hit the email bag and more of your calls coming up. Vox Pop Medical Monday. Strokes today with Dr. William Musser and Dr. Jonathan Walpaugh. The number is 800-348-2551. And doctors, a few email messages here. This one from Dan. Dan says, could you please comment on the correlation between chiropractic adjustment and the potential for strokes?
Yes, that is an interesting question. And so what happens in chiropractic, and this deals specifically with manipulation, with high-frequency manipulation, and I think we've all sort of seen images or videos of people who have gotten chiropractic adjustment, and their head is, sort of grabbed and moved at a very high speed and stopped abruptly. And what happens is when sometimes, and it is uncommon, but it does occur, and I think in my career I've seen it twice, that by doing high-frequency manipulation of the neck, it can actually damage one of two arteries at the back of the brain, and those are the vertebral arteries. We have two carotid arteries bringing blood up the front, if you will, and two vertebral arteries bringing blood up the back of the neck. And those vertebral arteries are very small, and there is a several millimeter area where they travel, and they travel up among, in the vertebral bodies of the spine in these little canals, and it's just a fairly simple small blood vessel. And so if the neck is moved quickly and stopped abruptly, it can cause a dissection. That is, it causes a tear in the wall of that vessel. And then blood flow, if the blood will travel up into the tear, and that closes off the lumen or the central part of the vessel, and so blood doesn't go up. And that's associated with what's called a brainstem stroke, a stroke to that part of the brain that sticks down called the brainstem. Again, it's uncommon. And my understanding from talking with chiropractors over the years is that they've gotten away from that particular type of manipulation. There are others that they do that are not associated with it. But yes, it is something that can occur.
All right. This one's from Sally. Sally says, what is the relationship between stroke and migraines with aura?
So there is a long-standing association between migraine and stroke. And it is particularly common with migraine with aura. Migraine is felt to be caused, or at least in part, by abnormalities in the blood vessel walls of the vessels in the brain. And so when someone has an aura, which means a transient neurological symptom that comes on, so some people with migraine, they may end up with visual symptoms as an aura. They may lose part of their vision, or they may see flashing lights, or they may end up with numbness and or weakness in an arm, or they may even end up with the speech disturbance called aphasia that is seen more commonly in people who have had a stroke. And so they can have a stroke from their migraine. It is something that neurologists, this is a condition that neurologists are very familiar with, and it can be treated. And there are just some certain things that you would do if you had a patient who had that kind of history, as opposed to someone who had a migraine without an aura, where they just got a headache. People do have, a migraine with aura can progress to a stroke. It is uncommon, but it also has a better prognosis than what we're thinking of when we talk about strokes, today.
We're joined today by Dr. Jonathan Walpaugh and Dr. William Musser. And this last email, and then back to the phones for the home stretch. This one's from Chuck. Chuck says, is it a good idea to give a person you think is having a stroke an aspirin along with calling 911? How would you interpret a stroke as compared to bleeding in the brain? In that case, an aspirin could be a mistake. So what's the deal now? Give an aspirin or don't give an aspirin? We'll go to Dr. Walpaugh first here.
Yeah, I would think at that point it's not something that's going to be of immediate help. But I think it does bring up a very interesting distinction, which Dr. Musser may want to say something more about the distinction between a clot versus a bleed. which is a very important one initially, particularly deciding acutely how to treat an apparent stroke.
Yes. So when someone has symptoms that look like a stroke, they are most commonly due to a stroke. That is, there's been interruption of blood flow to an area and symptoms arise from that. But some of the time, the symptoms are arising because a blood vessel in the brain has broken or burst, if you will, and there's been bleeding in the brain. So it's not a good idea if someone thinks they're having a stroke to take an aspirin at home. Because if someone had bleeding in the brain, the aspirin could make it worse or harder for that bleeding to stop on its own. And some people with bleeding in the brain actually require an emergency neurosurgical procedure, and having just taken an aspirin would make that more difficult to do. Aspirin thins the blood, and that is one time where you do not want to thin the blood.
We are joined today by Dr. Jonathan Wolpaw and Dr. William Musser, and let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Evie in Gloversville, you're on.
Well, this is actually Jim in Gloversville. Oh. Evie had to go into the store and left me to ask the question.
All right, you're the surrogate. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Our first question was cholesterol, and how does that relate, high cholesterol, how does that relate to strokes? And her second question was, if someone was having a stroke, would they be in a great deal of pain?
So let me answer your second question first, and that is that strokes are usually abrupt, so of sudden onset, and they are usually painless. There may be some pain associated with some stroke syndromes, but that pain tends to occur much later outside of the acute period. And your question about cholesterol is a good one, and it speaks to what is very important, and that is there are things that all of us can do to decrease our risk of stroke. And they include, if we have high blood pressure, it should be identified and treated. And the goal would be getting the blood pressure down to as close to normal, the normal range as possible. The second thing is, if someone, as they're getting older, if they have elevated cholesterol, it should be treated. It has been shown to be effective that treating cholesterol helps to prevent strokes, and you'll see if someone has a stroke and they are found to have high cholesterol or even normal cholesterol, they are treated with statin medications because the goal is to keep their cholesterol profile as good as possible. And then the third big risk factor would be if someone has diabetes. Their diabetes should be treated so that their blood sugar is as close to normal as possible. And then the other big risk is smoking. If someone smokes tobacco, they should stop smoking or cut down at the very least, because that is also a big risk factor.
Evie, thanks a lot. Or Jim and Evie, thank you for the call. Let's go to Paul in Florence, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you. This is a great show. I think you may have been talking about me a little bit because I'm concerned about hemorrhagic bleeds. I'm 68. I'm in really good health. I'm athletic. I'm on a statin to control the cholesterol. But 10 years ago, I had an unprovoked DVT and a lot of pulmonary emboli. And so I'm on chronic anticoagulation therapy. And I do have to wonder, with a PT INR of 1.5 to 2.0, if I'm at risk for a hemorrhagic bleed, sometime later in life.
So I think the kind of bleeding that people will see who are on anticoagulation is due to trauma, falling and hitting their head, slipping on ice outside in the winter like the one we're having. That's the risk. It's usually not kind of a spontaneous bleed. It sounds like you know your laboratory values, so it sounds like you follow very closely with your medical provider, and they're making sure that those values stay where they want them to stay. And it's always, with any treatment in medicine, it's looking at the risks versus the benefits. And it sounds like the benefits of this is that it's preventing you from having, pulmonary emboli, blood clots going to your heart.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it seems as though it's giving me protection. And I wear a helmet when I cross-country ski. I'm the only one out there wearing a helmet.
Good for you.
So I get a little Absolutely. Chuckle out of that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and my blood pressure is good, so I'm thinking so long as my arteries don't get too brittle, I should be good to go.
It sounds like you're working closely with your providers and keeping everything where it should be.
Sounds very reasonable.
Let's go back to our lines here, and somebody has been waiting a long time in Rhinebeck. Let's go to Grace in Rhinebeck. Grace, you're on.
Yes, hi. You answered my first question about the correlation between a classic migraine and stroke, but my stroke was from having a PFO.
What's a PFO?
So a PFO is a patent foramen ovale, and it's a hole between the two sides of the heart, if you will. And PFO is the foramen ovale is part of normal development when a fetus is developing and the heart is developing within that fetus. As the heart develops, what usually happens is that hole, and they call the foramen ovale, that closes. However, in some people, it doesn't close all of the way, and in some people, it actually stays open to such a degree that blood clots can travel from the venous system into the arterial system and produce a stroke. Now, what is interesting
right.
is
Am
that
I only...
PFO is a cause of stroke we look for in people who are younger and may not have some of the other risk factors that we've talked about. And what also has been shown to be effective is that if someone has a PFO and it's felt to be the cause of their stroke, it can be closed off. And it can be closed off through a procedure done through the groin cardiac catheterization type of procedure.
Yes, I had that procedure done.
Okay. Well, Grace, thank you very much for the call. Quickly now, let's go to, we only have about 3.5 minutes here, doctors.
Ray, I just wanted to follow up to what I was saying earlier about the advances that are now possible. I wanted to let people know that we have a variety of studies underway, some underway, some about to be started, based at the VA, looking at ways of improving treatments for people with strokes and improving recovery, particularly in people who've had strokes a while ago and are left with deficits. So we're interested in people who, particularly veterans, who might be interested in participating in those studies.
And how do people find out more about those?
They would contact us at the VA, at the National Center for Adaptive Neurotechnologies. We're also online at neurotechcenter.org so that people can contact us in those ways. But we are very much interested in people both who've had strokes as well or other kinds of neurological disorders, as well as people who would be interested in participating really as normal volunteers to help us develop new methods.
Very good.
These are ongoing, a variety of studies.
Dr. Musser, did you want to weigh in here?
No.
I thought I heard you begin to speak. All right, let's grab another call. I just want to say, if you were in the studio, you would see my hand cues. We'll go with an audio cue here. We have about 2 minutes exactly. When you hear Count Basie start to play the piano, we're going to wrap it up. Let's go to Becky in Northville. Becky, you're on.
Hi, I was just wondering if there is a connection between an AVM and stroke.
So an AVM is an abnormal collection of blood vessels in the brain. It's kind of, think of it as we have arteries that make their way down to capillaries and then back up to veins. And what an AVM or arteriovenous malformation is an enlarged kind of capillary bed forming kind of a nidus, a focus, and you have kind of a collection, an abnormal collection of blood there. Those vessels are not, they're
they're not as sturdy as regular blood vessels, if you will, and so they are. There is a risk of bleeding. People can have strokes from them. People seizures and bleeding are probably the two most common things. They are treated through a variety of neurosurgical and radiographic procedures.
Thank you.
Thank you. Quickly, now we have 1 minute. Tom in Queensbury, a very good question. You have 30 seconds to ask.
Okay, my question quickly. We spoke about bleeds versus non-bleeding strokes. My mother had a bleeding stroke in the late 90s. Do hospitals now have the ability to quickly determine which one you're having?
Yes, they do. It can be determined with a simple head CT scan that is done without contrast, and that can be done within a minute or two. It's very fast.
Okay, great. And they can determine the treatment very quickly after that then?
That's correct.
Okay, great. That's all I wanted to know. Thank you very much.
Well done, Tom, and we thank you very much. Dr. Walpaugh, once again, how do people find out more about the research that you guys are doing?
Well, they can look online at neurotechcenter.org. They can contact us at the National Center for Adaptive Neurotechnologies, which is at the VA. Okay. Those would be the primary means of doing that.
And Dr. Musser, the National Telestroke Program, how do people find out more about that?
I think you can Google the National Telestroke Program. Mm-hmm. for our veterans. In the listening area, they should know that we are here at the Albany VA. It's one of our sites, and White River Junction, Vermont, might be a bit far away, but that's also one of our sites.
Well, both of you, thank you so much for being here. Great job, and we will talk to you soon. Support comes from Genesee Comfort, maker of tailored tensile robes, a new gift idea for people in nursing homes and receiving care, providing medical access without disrobing. Locally based, hospital compliant, Janesi Comfort.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. William Musser and Dr. Jonathan Walpaugh for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Amber Sickles for taking the calls. Our engineer, Zach Malloy, our producer, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we discuss antiques with Mark Lawson. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.